And so we're on to item five, review of private credit. 5A is presentation from staff. Is Rishi leading us, or Tim, are you going to introduce this item?
I'm just going to introduce this briefly and then turn it over to Rishi to walk through kind of the staff review of private credit. But just a couple of foundational things for the trustees to keep in mind as we step through this. This is an allocation that was approved in 2016. We started the process of identifying partners in the space and ultimately selected StepStone and began funding the strategy in 2018. So we're about 2 years into it. It's not fully funded yet, but we're making considerable progress there. At the time, it was a 12% target allocation, which roughly translated to about a $1 billion total commitment at that point in time. That, with the growth of the fund, is probably down to closer to an 11% commitment today, but we'll be reviewing asset allocation, of course, in the next month or so. So if there's any revisions, we can deal with them at that time. I think this is a timely discussion simply because of the changing landscape of fixed income globally, with the interest rates dropping so dramatically this year, and a lot of new capital coming into the private credit space. So Rishi is going to review the asset class and some of the operational considerations that we keep in mind as we build this. It's a broad and diverse asset class. We have chosen very specific parts of the broader private credit arena to focus our attention. And then after Rishi kind of steps through what the asset class is, how it functions, we're going to turn it over to StepStone, and they'll review implementation to date and performance in the current lending environment. So with that, I'll ask Rishi to come online, and if he could take over as presenter status and share his slides, that would be great.
Morning, everybody.
Morning.
Let me just get the slides going. Okay. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
See, you're coming through clearly. Thank you.
Great, great. So as Tim mentioned, we're going to speak about private credit today. So I'll kick us off with a high-level overview of the asset class, including the history and evolution of the private credit market. And I'll also speak more specifically about direct lending, which is the primary exposure in CCIRO's private credit program. It represents about 90% of our current exposure. And then following my presentation, you'll hear from the StepStone private debt team. They'll provide a private credit market update, including the impact of COVID-19, and they'll also cover CCIRO's private credit program and portfolio performance. So before I get started, just for the trustees, please feel free to jump in at any time with questions during the presentation. I'll also pull the various points to see if there are any questions or comments. So turning to the first section of the presentation now. This is just meant to be provide some high-level context on CCIRO's private credit program. First slide here is the role of private credit in CCIRO's portfolio. Let's see. Are the trustees seeing, also, are the slides blocked by the GoToMeeting windows that I have open here? Let me see.
I can see it. If any trustee is having trouble, please speak up.
Okay, so you can see the slides clearly. Okay, good.
Yes.
So as you can see, private credit falls in as a part of CCIRO's growth allocation. It sits in the same bucket as CCIRO's equity strategies. It is a return-seeking strategy for CCIRO, so with a current long-term return target of 10% net IRR. Historically, private credit has had lower return volatility than equities, but it still generated returns that met the requirements of CCIRO's growth allocation. But in order to achieve these returns, there are certain risks that the credit program needs to take, and I'll talk about those risks later in the presentation. You can see that private credit currently represents about 7% of Cicero's total portfolio. The program began investing in the second quarter of 2018 and has ramped up since then. As Tim mentioned, the current long-term target for private credit is 12%. And based on projected investment pacing, we expect the program to be fully deployed and close to that 12% target in 2021, at which time it'll be about around $1 billion in size. Currently, the program is about $630 million in size. Moving on to the next slide here, I just try to lay out some of the key participants in Cicero's private credit program and what each participant focuses on day to day. In addition to what's on this slide, an important role is Cicero's periodic monitoring role of the overall program. And that in part is what the purpose of today's presentation is, but this slide here focuses more on the day-to-day roles. So Cicero provides advice to StepStone related to portfolio construction and strategy analysis. StepStone plays a pivotal role in Cicero's private credit program in that they manage the overall program, including portfolio management and strategy and manager selection. And finally, through StepStone, Cicero partners with investment managers who source and evaluate, execute and monitor the underlying private credit investments that Cicero ultimately has exposure to. So there are other participants in the private credit ecosystem, but I thought these were the ones worth mentioning for our purposes today. So this section was just meant to provide some high-level context before we jump into the heart of the presentation, but I'll pause here in case there are any questions. Okay, moving on. So next we're gonna try to define private credit. The first slide here, you'll see a selection of quotes that are trying to define the private credit asset class. These quotes were selected from a survey of 60 private credit investment managers based throughout the world that collectively manage about $400 billion in assets. While there's some consistencies between the quotes, you can probably tell that it isn't easy even for private credit investment managers to agree on a consistent definition of the asset class. That said, I thought there were something valuable in many of these quotes. You see some managers mention the asset class being wide. You see them saying private credit meaning different things to different people, it including non-bank lending and directly negotiated transactions of illiquid, unrated debt. So overall, I thought this was a good starting point to try to piece together a definition that's meaningful for our purposes today. So flipping over to the next slide, you can see my shot at trying to define the asset class for our purposes. I defined it as non-bank lending that includes directly negotiated transactions of illiquid, unrated debt. Is a wide range of strategies and risk return profiles within the asset class, and returns can range from mid single digits all the way to 20% plus, depending on the strategy. In addition to the asset class being broad, private credit programs can also have wide-ranging mandates, anywhere from a low-risk capital preservation type mandate to a higher-risk return maximization mandate, and everything in between. And so what private credit means to a particular investment program will largely be determined by the goals of their specific private credit mandate. On this page, I've tried to show a broad range of strategies and sub-strategies within private credit, so you can get a feel for the breadth of the asset class. StepStone helps Cicero monitor these strategies. Despite the broad range of options here, Cicero's exposures have been more targeted, and those are shown by the red highlighted boxes. In fact, 90% of Cicero's exposure is in U.S. direct lending, and that's the red highlighted box on the top left in this slide. So we'll be talking a lot about direct lending today. Direct lending for our purposes is essentially senior loans to companies that generate up to $100 million in EBITDA or annual operating cash flow.
Question, Rishi.
Yes.
In reading this, and this stuff was great. I thought the page of quotes and really defining what we do in the world of private credit was really helpful because I wasn't entirely clear. And given the breadth of this subject, although I didn't go back and read the investment policy before the meeting, I wondered, just as a placeholder, if you think, or Tim thinks, there's any utility in more, I guess for lack of a better term, more narrowly defining what we do in the world of private credit or what our policy says we should do. Because I was struck by how wide a berth this really is. I hadn't really focused on it previously, and it's an enormously broad category, given that we have ultimately a 12% target commitment into this space. Anyway, food for thought, wondering if you or Tim have a thought on whether we think we should more narrowly define what we do, or maybe we already have. I'm just not sure.
Sure. Go ahead, Tim.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to say, I think this has been an evolving asset class, and certainly when we went through the asset allocation in 2015 and adopted a target allocation in 2016, I don't think the level of definitional rigidity that we're seeing on this page had really coalesced in the marketplace at that point in time. You know, it was basically, what are banks not doing, and can we provide capital at an attractive risk-adjusted return in that space? I think Richie took the slide out, but we did have a slide in here about kind of the all-weather approach to direct lending, and at various points in time, other things are going to be interesting. And the corollary really is, within private equity, we have a private equity allocation. Now, private equity is everything from large buyouts to small buyouts to some special situations and venture capital. And we haven't gone down the path of identifying each, you know, target allocations, each one of those. We know that large buyouts is going to be the bulk of it, but at various points in time, something else might be interesting. So I think there's an argument to be made for some breadth here, but certainly as we move through the asset liability study in a month, that would be a point in time to, you know, press Verus on, hey, we're looking at this large asset class. Is it time to put more definition around it? I think that's a worthwhile conversation. I don't know that the evolution has gone far enough to justify it yet, but I think it's a worthwhile conversation.
And just to add a little bit to that, I mean, I think Tim covered it, but yeah, some strategies being all weather, like direct lending, and maybe you can participate in that strategy regardless of where you are in the credit cycle, whereas other strategies, like maybe a distressed strategy, only really makes sense to look at, through a downturn and an early recovery. So the relative value and the relative attractiveness of each of these areas is not set at a point in time. It's often changing. And so monitoring the return relative to the risk in these asset classes can give us a better sense of where the best relative value is across this wide asset class at a point in time. Okay. Moving on. So the dominant strategy within private credit is corporate lending, and corporate lending is also currently the dominant strategy in CSERA's portfolio through our exposure to the direct lending strategy. So I thought it would make sense to provide a high-level overview of private credit corporate lending strategies. Here you see an example of a corporate capital structure with debt and equity securities. This isn't meant to be all-inclusive in terms of every security you could find in a corporate capital structure. It's just for illustrative purposes, so we can talk about where different private credit corporate lending strategies participate in a company's capital structure. So on the left-hand side of the capital structure, you see performing strategies. Direct lending is at the top. Again, these are primarily senior loans and participate at the top of the capital structure. Mezzanine debt is junior debt that is subordinate to the senior debt and participates below direct lending in the capital structure. And of course, below debt, you have equity securities. Moving over to the right side of the capital structure, you see non-performing strategy of distressed debt, and that can participate throughout the debt portion of the capital structure. In the case of a liquidation, the debt is paid first, starting with senior debt and flowing down the capital structure, and in terms of losses, those flow to equity first, and then to debt, and then within debt, they flow first to the junior or subordinated debt, and then to the senior debt like the direct lending strategy. Again, primary exposure for CCERA is direct lending. We'll touch a little bit on some of the other corporate lending strategies during the presentation, but our main focus today is going to be on direct lending. So flipping over to the next slide, there's a lot more to corporate lending than just private credit corporate lending. So this slide shows how private credit corporate lending fits into the broader corporate lending universe. So first, we can divide corporate lending into investment grade and unrated or non-investment grade. Private credit falls into the unrated or non-investment grade category, together with broadly syndicated loans and high yield debt. You can see from this graphic that private credit focuses on companies with up to 100 million of EBITDA or annual cash flow, while broadly syndicated loans and high yield bonds focus on larger companies. Banks and used to play a larger role in senior loans to smaller companies. So think of it as the gray box in the top left here. But they've been pulling back from that part of the market since the great financial crisis due to regulatory pressure. And that's left a funding gap that has been filled by private credit. And I'll talk more about that in the next section of the presentation. But for now, let's flip over to the next page, and we're gonna talk about comparing private credit strategies and evaluating risk and return. So as I mentioned earlier, in order for CCERA to try to achieve its targeted return of 10% net IRR, the private credit program has to take on certain risks. Given that private credit is part of CCERA's growth allocation and sits alongside equity strategies, the need for this risk exposure, I don't think it's surprising, but I think it's still worth noting. Some of the market commentary we read lumps all credit strategies, including private credit, into the low-risk bucket, and that is inconsistent with the role of private credit in CCERA's portfolio. It's a return-seeking strategy that must take on certain risks to try to achieve its targeted returns. Looking at this chart shows gross returns. So think of it as CCERA needing to consider strategies that target at least low to mid-teens gross returns on this chart to meet the 10% net return target. When choosing strategies to include in any private credit program, the return target is a key consideration, but it's just one piece of the puzzle. The other equally important consideration is the level of risk that must be assumed to achieve that level of return. So looking at the chart now for the private credit strategies shown, risk and return both generally increase as you go down the list of strategies, from senior infrastructure debt to distressed debt. So for example, if you had a private credit program that wanted to prioritize low risk and had a low return target, then maybe you would focus more on senior infrastructure debt and similar strategies. Conversely, if you wanted to prioritize return maximization and were comfortable with high levels of risk, then maybe you would focus more on high octane strategies like distressed debt. I'd say CCERA's private credit program is somewhere in between those two extremes. The return target's high enough that it effectively rules out certain lower risk, lower returning strategies. So think of that as everything from senior infrastructure debt through to unlevered direct lending. The returns for those strategies are generally not meet CCERA's return target. But CCERA's return target isn't so high that we would need to allocate the entire private credit program to the highest octane strategies like distressed debt. In fact, 90% of the exposure, 90% of exposure in CCERA's private credit program is in levered direct lending. That's the second green bar in the chart on this slide. So we'll get into more details about levered direct lending when we get to the direct lending section. But for now, let me pause and see if there are any questions. Okay, good. So next we can look to the history and evolution of the private credit market. So I think when looking at the history of the private credit market, it's helpful to divide that history into pre-Great Financial Crisis and post-Great Financial Crisis. Focusing on the pre-Great Financial Crisis period first, private credit began to emerge as an asset class in the late 80s, early 90s, for about 20 years, from late 80s, early 90s, all the way up to the great financial crisis. The asset class was around, but was relatively unspectacular compared to what it has morphed into in recent years. In fact, you know, I think pre-GFC, I'm not sure participants within the private credit asset class would have even agreed that it was a separate asset class. The main strategies were distressed and mezzanine at that time, and the asset class had about $250 billion in assets under management in 2008. And direct lending was an insignificant portion of the asset class at that time. Now, moving on to the post-GFC period, the asset class has completely changed. It's tripled in size from it's more than tripled in size from $250 billion in 2008 to over $800 billion in 2019. The dominant strategies are no longer distressed and mezzanine. Those strategies still exist, but direct lending has replaced those strategies as the dominant strategy within the asset class. The growth of direct lending has driven the growth and evolution of private credit overall. And this all happened relatively quickly during the last decade or so. The chart on this slide just shows this transformation graphically over time. You can see how market share within the asset class has shifted from distressed debt and mezzanine strategies to direct lending. And all of that happened while the asset class was tripling in size. So the natural question is, what changed? Why, after 20 relatively benign years for the asset class, has it transformed so much in the last decade or so? And you know, what were the catalysts for this change? And turning to the next page, the reality is that there were probably a few catalysts that coincided to drive rapid growth and transformation of the asset class. First, regulatory pressures caused banks to pull back from the direct lending market, and leaving a funding gap. So essentially, regulators made it more expensive for banks to lend to small and medium-sized enterprises, and so banks withdrew from that end of the market. While banks were pulling back from that end of the market, demand for direct lending was increasing as private equity was growing as an asset class post the GFC. So this growing demand for capital from small and medium-sized companies, while supply of that capital from banks was decreasing, is what created a large funding gap. And private credit and the direct lending strategy more specifically moved in to fill that funding gap and grew significantly as a result. I think it's also important to note that private credit likely would not have grown as rapidly without sufficient institutional investor interest. Since the great financial crisis, low yield environment we've been in has caused institutional investors like Cicera to move into private market asset classes in search of yield. So private equity and private credit have both benefited from that yield seeking behavior. As you can see in this chart, below, private credit, private equity and private credit grew at 11% at compound annual growth rates from 2008 to 2019, and both asset classes have more than tripled in size during that time. Direct lending, again, has driven the growth in private credit, and private equity has been the primary consumer of private credit's direct lending product. Unsurprisingly, there have been several new entrants to the direct lending market post the GFC, and that's increased competition within the strategy. So from a market perspective, that's where we are today. Direct lending has grown significantly since the GFC to be the dominant strategy within private credit. Banks have pulled back from the direct lending market due to regulatory pressures. Private equity has grown significantly, which has supported the growth of direct lending and private credit. Competition within direct lending has increased, and institutional investor interest still remains high given the yield potential of the asset class and that we remain in a low interest rate environment. So I'll pause you again for any questions before we move on to the direct lending section. Okay, moving on. So this is the second time you've seen this slide today. Previously, you spoke about broadly about comparing different private credit strategies. Now we're going to focus on the levered direct lending strategy specifically. So, and that again is Cicera's primary exposure. So I'll explain the difference between levered direct lending and unlevered direct lending more in the coming slides. But as you recall, Direct lending for all purposes is primarily senior loans to companies with up to 100 million of EBITDA or annual operating cash flow. Again, in order to achieve targeted returns within private credit, there's some risk we need to assume. So now let me address some of the specific risks in leveraged direct lending, keeping in mind that this makes up the bulk of CCO's exposure. So first up, realized loan losses and impairment of principal and interest. This seems like an obvious risk, but I think it's actually more noteworthy for direct lending compared to certain other strategies, because there's no upside in direct lending beyond collection of principal and interest. So for example, in direct lending, if you incur losses that are higher than anticipated, it's very likely that your aggregate returns are going to be impaired. Again, that seems obvious, but it's slightly different to other return-seeking strategy within CSERA's growth allocation. So in private equity, for example, you may incur higher losses than expected in certain investments, but then maybe you also generate higher returns than expected in other investments because your upside isn't capped in private equity. So it's possible that you still meet your overall return target despite incurring higher losses than expected. That scenario is impossible in direct lending because there are no outsized winners to compensate for larger than expected losses. And so focusing on losses and focusing on minimizing losses in direct lending becomes even more important. Now, historically, the return volatility of direct lending has been lower than equity strategies, losses have been reasonable, and the asset class, the risk return has been good compared to equities and other corporate lending strategies. But I still thought that that risk was worth noting. I think it's also worth recalling that direct lending loans are loans to smaller leveraged companies. Direct lending loan portfolios often have meaningful exposure to cyclical industries like consumer discretionary and industrials that may not perform as well as other sectors in an economic downturn. Direct lending loans are illiquid, meaning that capital is typically tied up for at least 2 to 3 years and often longer. It's difficult and often not possible to trade out of loan positions to generate liquidity, to mitigate losses, or to manage portfolio exposures. As we touched on earlier, direct lending has grown rapidly, and competition within the asset class has increased, and that's has led to less protective loan structuring and loan agreements, though we've seen some of that reverse post-COVID. There's also been downward pressure on yields from that competition and also from the low interest rate environment that we've been in. And then finally, of course, putting leverage on the direct lending strategy creates the risk of more severe negative returns in the case of a downturn. And leverage is obviously a double-edged sword. Generally speaking, when returns are positive, that leverage increases those positive returns. But if returns turn negative, then leverage would also cause those returns to become more negative. Despite those risks, there are also some mitigants. Firstly, I think it's important to keep in mind that while direct lending doesn't share in the upside returns like equity does, it may also not share in all of the downside of a company's performance. So, for example, you could have a company that has declining revenue and earnings, but as long as that company is able to make its interest and principal payments on its direct lending loan, then the direct lending strategy generates its targeted returns. In that scenario, the returns to equity for that particular company may be subpar, but direct lending returns wouldn't be impacted. Another important way to try to mitigate risk in a direct lending portfolio is through diversification. Diversification by investment year, by manager, by industry, and by underlying company. As a point of reference, CSERA has exposure to over 230 borrowers in 10 sectors across 18 managers in the current portfolio. And the goal of CSERA's private credit program so far has been to be right at the top of the capital structure. So first lien or unitranche makes up almost all of the loans in the portfolio. Protective covenants is another important mitigant and has been an important focus so far in the private credit program. in the case of underperformance, covenants allow lenders to influence a company's operating decisions earlier in the process, with the goal of trying to protect their loans. So covenants are important. And Cicero has exposure to one or more covenants on 97% of the loans in the portfolio. And finally, manager selection is very important. So, top-down evaluation and choice of strategies is also important. But if you choose the wrong managers to implement those strategies, then you may not achieve your goals. Our largest commitment and overall exposure in the portfolio is currently with a manager that has been in direct lending for 25 years. So that's a long investment track record, despite being in a relatively young asset class, and has invested across multiple macroeconomic cycles, also has proven lookout capabilities. So if something goes wrong on a particular loan, they have expertise to work out those situations and try to maximize recovery. Those were examples of specific risks and mitigants within direct lending strategy, but zooming out for a minute, from an historical perspective, direct lending has had an attractive risk-reward profile compared to other corporate lending strategies. It's generally had lower losses and better risk-adjusted returns than comparable corporate lending strategies. I think the major caveat is that most of that history is since the GFC, during the longest economic expansion on record, when frankly it was a good time to be an investor in most asset classes. The current dislocation that's been driven by COVID-19, it may be the first true test of the strategy in its current form. And I think it's going to take some time before we're able to observe the ultimate impact of this downturn on direct lending. So I think it's going to be important for us to monitor the winners and losers among the investment managers and among the sectors. And then also to compare the realized loss rates from this downturn to historical loss rates. I think that would put us in a position to be able to better evaluate the performance of the asset class and the strategies that we've chosen and to confirm whether they remain attractive. Okay, so there was a lot on that slide. But moving on, we don't have to spend a lot. Sorry, go ahead, John.
Well, we're still on this topic. The borrowers, for the most part, are not bank creditworthy, as I understand it. In other words, banks would charge a lower interest rate than we are going to receive, but they don't qualify for banks. So these are somewhat impaired borrowers. How do we value these loans over time? At a bank, you'd have reserves established. And as you're well aware, as we got into March, April, most of the big banks substantially increased their reserves against loans that would likely go bad. How do we measure that? How do we control it? And when do we recognize some part of a loss when the lender is in fact paying the interest, but in their balance sheet is clearly going south, downhill?
Great question, Sean. So first, to address the portion of the question about banks and these not being creditworthy from a bank standpoint, I would say, in 2010, banks probably made up 60% of the transactions in the small end of the market. And that has declined from 2010 to 2017. I think they were about 25% of the deals in the market. So the banks had been active in this on this end of the market. Now, I think post GFC there was regulation from Dodd-Frank and I think Basel III in Europe, where all loans to corporate loans to smaller entities were rated as riskier by the regulators. And so because they were just they took that broad approach to all loans to smaller companies, banks were required to keep more reserves on their balance sheets for potential losses if they were going to make these loans to companies. And so, what that effectively meant is that it made it more expensive for banks to make these loans. So if they were to make these loans, I'm not sure, where they would land in terms of how much they'd need to charge. It's you know, it's possible that their cost of capital might be higher than the cost of capital for some of the direct lending investment managers. So that's the first portion of the question. To speak to how the losses flow through, so there are market-based forces that that determine the valuations of the portfolios for our private debt and direct lending managers. And so in the first quarter, we saw write-downs of loan portfolios, and StepStone will speak a little bit more to this in their presentation. So even though, you know, I'd say generally speaking, the borrowers in our portfolio were able to shore up liquidity, they were generally able to make their interest payments, managers still recognized that there was a market dislocation, and so they took a write-down, a paper write-down to the valuations. And how they do their valuation, they look at market-based spreads and what the risk is for similar loans. They also look at comparable transactions that are being done for loans and how those are being priced. And I think in the first quarter, there weren't many transactions being done towards the end of the first quarter and early in the second quarter. So those comparable transactions weren't as easy to come by. But what managers were able to observe in the market helped them to determine what the appropriate write-downs were in the portfolio. So we did see some write-downs. That said, you know, managers have some level of discretion. There are checks to make sure that managers are valuing portfolios well, but they have some level of discretion in how they mark their portfolios. And so, you know, we can't just only look at how they're valuing it. We also need to look at what are the actual defaults that we're seeing, default rates that we're seeing in the portfolio. And over time, you know, how will those turn into workout situations, restructurings, and ultimately losses? And so, you know, taking a step back for one second, my view at the moment, you know, StepStone will have more on this, is that post-COVID, companies did a relatively good job, and private equity sponsors did a relatively good job of working together, providing liquidity where it was needed, cutting costs at companies quickly, and ensuring up liquidity. And so, you know, I think from a liquidity standpoint, a lot of companies bought time for 6, 9, 12 months. I think a question and uncertainty, at least to me at the moment, is, you know, how will demand come back for those companies over time? Will there be, you know, if there are prolonged lockdowns or there are additional shelter in place orders, and that could impact some of those companies. So those are my thoughts. That was a long-winded answer. I hope it got to some of your question, but I'll pause in case I didn't address something.
That was a good answer. I just sort of a bottom line. You and of course by extension Tim are comfortable that we do not have hidden unrealized losses in our direct loan portfolio that should have been recognized during the last 2, 3, 4 months. And at some point in the future, obviously, will be. But you're comfortable that we are valuing it appropriately.
I think generally right now, I'd say I'm comfortable because I feel that the liquidity of the borrowers in the portfolio has been shored up for a period of time. And then, you know, the uncertainty is around whether the demand comes back in time for those companies to be able to continue to make their principal and interest payments.
Okay.
So moving on, we don't have to spend a lot of time on this slide, but this is an example that I'm going to use to try to explain the difference between levered and unlevered direct lending. So this is a levered separately managed account structure. The majority of CSERA's levered direct lending exposure is through separately managed accounts. So I thought it would be relevant to talk through this graphic. This is an example of a one-to-one leverage. So for every dollar contributed by an investor like Cicera to the SMA, there's also a dollar contributed by a third-party lender. And that results in 50% of the capital being provided by the SMA investor. That's the dark green box here. And 50% of the capital being provided by a third-party lender, which is the light green box. And the capital from the SMA investor and the third-party lender is then pooled together and used to make direct lending loans to various companies within the SMA. In contrast, in an unlevered direct lending strategy, 100% of the capital in the SMA would be provided by the SMA investor, so an institution like Cicera. So the light green box in this chart wouldn't be there in an unlevered direct lending strategy. And the dark green box would make up 100% of the capital in the SMA. So that's it on the difference between levered and direct lending. We're essentially talking about whether there's permanent leverage at the SMA level or in the case of a fund at the fund level. And if there is, then that's determined to be a levered strategy. The leverage obviously comes with benefits, costs, and associated risks. And generally, as long as aggregate returns at the SMA level are positive, leverage is helpful in that it multiplies those positive returns to investors. However, if aggregate returns turn negative at the SMA level, then leverage also multiplies those negative returns. So it's a double-edged sword. And another important point is that the third-party debt provided at the SMA level is typically cross-collateralized by all the loans in the SMA. So that means, for example, the loan if the loan from company one in this chart starts to underperform, then that impacts the same debt facility that was used to fund companies two and three. And in the case of underperforming loans, Cicera may be required to contribute additional capital to the third-party lender at the SMA level to cure those underperforming loans. So, you know, given the current market dislocation that we're in, this potential need for Cicera to contribute additional capital is being monitored closely. To date, Cicera has not been required to make significant capital contributions to cure underperforming loans. But the situation is fluid, and we continue to monitor it closely. Okay, moving on. So there's a lot on this slide. This slide and the next two slides walks through how capital flows into direct lending loans and then how returns flow from those direct lending loans back to investors like Cicera. This first slide is an example of a direct lending transaction, a sponsor-backed direct lending transaction, and shows the flow of funds that leads to the strategy-level return generated by the direct lending strategy. So there's a lot on this page. Let's start with the top section above the blue dashed line. So this is an example of a sponsor-backed transaction that gives rise to a direct lending loan. In this example, a private equity sponsor buys a company A for $200. The PE sponsor funds $100 of the purchase price. The direct lending SMA provides the other $100. And that $200 total purchase price is used to pay the equity purchase price to the former owners, refinance all debt, and has a few other uses. After the transaction, company A has a $100 loan or liability on its balance sheet that's owed to the direct lending SMA. The loan typically has a five-year term. In this example, we assume it's repaid at maturity at the end of year five. In reality, many direct lending loans are repaid in 2 to 3 years despite having five-year terms. So you can think of the sponsor transaction above the blue dashed line here as occurring at time zero. Now, if we move on to the section below the blue dashed line, starting in year one, company A starts making interest payments on its $100 loan to the direct lending SMA. You'll see that the interest is floating rate interest, meaning that it usually is a base rate like LIBOR plus a spread. As LIBOR changes, the amount of interest owed also changes, with one important caveat. There's usually a LIBOR floor that's negotiated with direct lending by direct lending SMEs. So even if LIBOR decreases below the agreed upon floor, in this case it's 1%, the lowest LIBOR rate that is used to calculate interest is the floor rate of 1%. So in year one and two, you can see that LIBOR is 0.5% and the spread to LIBOR is 8.5%. If we just used LIBOR plus spread, that would get us to 9%. But the interest rate is actually 9.5% because instead of using the 0.5% LIBOR, we're using the 1% LIBOR floor. You can also see that when LIBOR increases above the floor in years four and five, the higher LIBOR of 2% is used plus the 8.5% spread, which calculates to a 10.5% interest rate. So interest is paid during the term of the loan, and when principal is returned at the end of the loan term in year five. You can see in this example, it results in a 1.5 times gross multiple of invested capital and a 10% gross IRR to the direct lending SMA. Again, this is the strategy level return. But from the strategy level return, there's still quite a bit that needs to happen between this and then paying out net returns to investors. And so the next two slides really try to bridge from the strategy level return to the net return earned by investors like Cicero. How an investor chooses to implement a direct lending strategy will impact how strategy level returns are impacted to get to a net return. So key impacts of leverage, loss rates, manager fees and expenses are based on those implementation decisions. So there are a few numbers on this page. This just shows assumptions that I'm using to bridge from gross unlevered returns to net levered returns. And again, this is just for illustrative purposes. In the box here, in the column labeled unlevered, you can see that starting with a 10% gross return, think of that as flowing from the prior page, that only gets you to 6.6% net return after assumed fees, losses, and expenses. Again, that's in the unlevered column. So this would be lower than Cicero's 10% net return target. In this example, leverage would be needed to multiply those unlevered returns to try to get to a 10% net return target. I think that the next slide is actually more helpful in that it shows a graphical representation of the assumptions from the prior slide. You can see that here that we start with a 10% gross IRR at the company level, which is the strategy level, which is the first blue bar on the left. Then the leverage at the SMA level, we're assuming one-to-one leverage here, helps to multiply that return, so it gets to 20%. And then there's a cost to the leverage. There's a cost to having investment managers implement the strategy on our behalf. And there are also estimated losses baked into the assumptions. So you see that after those costs and estimated losses, you get back down to a 10.5% net IRR to investors. I think it's worthwhile noting, this is just one example of how you can get to a targeted return of 10% net IRR. There are other parts within direct lending. So you could start with a lower yield at the company level. So maybe it's a slightly safer loan, but then maybe you would use more leverage at the SMA level. And maybe you're incurring lower incentive and management fees because they're safer and easier loans to manage. But ultimately, you could still get to your targeted return. So different parts to getting to a targeted return, even within direct lending. In summary, for this presentation, banks have pulled back from direct lending since the GFC, while demand for direct lending has remained robust. The funding gap that was created by banks pulling back has been filled by private credit and the direct lending strategy, and that's been fueled by institutional investors' desire for yield. Competition for deals and the low interest rate environment is putting downward pressure on risk-adjusted yields. So said differently, a relatively higher level of risk has been required recently to generate a given level of return versus the level of risk that might have been needed to generate that same return at the inception of Cicero's private credit program. It's a relatively young asset class that's currently going through its first major downturn. So I think it's still early to tell how this downturn will play out for private credit and the direct lending strategy. As I mentioned, it'll take time for defaults to turn into losses. and for workouts and recoveries to take place. So we'll continue to monitor the performance of the asset class through the downturn. I think it's going to be interesting to see which managers, sectors, market segments emerge as winners and losers, and to see how realized losses compare to historical loss rates. And you know, we're hoping that valuable information will come out of this downturn that will help to guide future decision making for the private credit program. So that brings me to the end of my presentation. Thank you for your attention. I'll pause here for any questions before handing over to the steps.
Rishi, this is Mike.
Hi, Mike.
Could you give me an example on, you know, back when you're going through the net return calculations, the 2% estimated losses? Could you give me an example of what those losses might be?
Sure. So that's when I spoke about impairment of principal and interest. So, you know, in this example, you showed here interest was being paid each year and then the principal was returned. Now, if a company starts to underperform and they don't have the liquidity or the cash flow, they aren't generating enough operating cash flow to be able to pay back all of their debt or to make all of their interest payments, then it's possible that you don't receive all of your interest and all of your principal. And you might actually end up, even though you loaned, in this example, $100, maybe you only receive $98 back. And so then that would be a realized loss that you would incur. Now, I think it brings up a good point, though. You know, historically, the loss rates here we're showing 2%, and that's based on a 1% loss rate that's then levered. Historically, the loss rates for direct lending have been, you know, just prior to the GFC, within the 200 to 300 basis point range in those vintages just prior to the GFC, which were probably some of the worst vintages that we have for this asset class. But then post the GFC, you know, 2009 through to today, the loss rates have been more in the 50 to 100 basis point range per year. So historically, the asset class has performed well. But again, this dislocation, I think, will provide us with valuable information about how losses are going to play out.
Great. Thank you.
Rishi, this is Jerry. I have a question. Could you give us and refresh my memory, I guess, at least, as whether or not there's any particular concentration in a sector or an industry that might give us pause with regard to what the performance might be on the downturn, or are we well diversified?
Yeah, it's a great question, Jerry. So, you know, these loans being loans to smaller companies, those companies are typically concentrated in some cases in some cyclical industries. And so when we look at our portfolio, we have, you know, I think it's close to 30% exposure in consumer discretionary. For example, we have 18% exposure in industrials. I think those are two really important exposures that we're going to need to monitor. Those are obviously cyclical industries. Not all companies within those industries are impacted the same, but those are certainly exposures that we're focused on. Now, on the flip side, we also have 20% exposure to healthcare and information technology, which is less cyclical. We have limited exposure to leisure, limited exposure to energy, which I think are positives. But I think some of that, you know, that exposure to consumer discretionary and industrials are certainly exposures that we're focusing on and monitoring.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for Rishi? I don't see any green lights coming on, so I think all questions have been answered. Thank you so much for the presentation. Excellent job.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. I'm going to try to figure out how to stop sharing the screen.
Great.
Here we go.
Success.